This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Swuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
There's no water and there's no electricity, so it's no wonder that many stopped functioning because it is extremely difficult, almost impossible to work in this condition.
That's International Committee of the Red Cross Africa spokesperson Alona Sinenko on the challenges hospitals are facing in Sudan's capital Khartoum. Details coming up. Also, Senegalese opposition leader Ousmane Sonko urges supporters to join him on a march of defiance. And one of the last four people indicted for Rwanda's 1994 genocide has been arrested. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. The African Union is celebrating Africa Day and its 60th anniversary today while promoting the African Continental Free Trade Area, an agreement by African leaders to boost the continent's economy. VOA's Mike Hovey has our report.
In 2018, 44 African nations signed onto the African Union brokered African Continental Free Trade Area, AFCFTA, to strengthen trade in Africa and make the continent's economies more competitive. 10 more African nations have since become signatories, with only Eritrea absent. Achaleke Christian Leke, the AU Youth Ambassador for Peace to Central Africa, says the AFCFTA will help Africa capitalize on its raw materials, innovative products, and market to Africans.
And even in countries where they are a bit advanced, other African countries cannot benefit, you know, from this. And I think that's why this glorious idea of the Africa Free Trade Zone is so important. It's so timely.
The Secretariat of the AFCFTA says Africa's population of about 1.3 billion people creates a $3.4 trillion free trade bloc. The Secretariat says the trade agreement could lift 30 million people out of extreme poverty and raise income levels to $450 billion by 2035. The AFCFTA aims to break down tariffs and other barriers that often make it cheaper and faster for African nations to trade outside the continent than with their neighbors. What's more, several experts warn the AFCFTA could fail if African leaders do not address underlying challenges such as rampant corruption and poor infrastructure. Tanatsiwa Dambuza, an advocate of the AFCFTA and the co-founder of Zimbabwe Institute of African Integration, says those problems hamper smaller and medium-sized businesses.
We also talk of corruption at the borders. The small and medium enterprises, the young people, the women also suffer because the police officers, sometimes they ask for bribes.
Even so, Kukuletsu Siso, the founder of Chimeza, an African tech startup focused on providing credit to young entrepreneurs, says it's important that SMEs in Africa embrace the AFCFTA.
So imagine you as a youth in South Africa sitting and thinking that this thing is going to impact, it's not going to impact you, but you've got an e-commerce site and in 2 years' time, someone like Jumia is suddenly going to be able to operate in your market with a free-for-all. How exactly do you protect your market share, right?
CISO challenges SMEs to financially and logistically prepare for the potential changes the agreement can bring to Africa. Mike Ove, VOA News, Washington.
Today is Africa Day, and reporter Ruben Chama in Nairobi spoke to people there about what Africa Day means to them. Here are a few of their comments.
My name is Daisy Kerema. I'm a graduate. I'm a strategic management graduate. To me, when I hear the word Africa Day, I think of how we celebrate Africa as a whole, ourselves as Africans, just the concept we have of Africa. And I think it brings so much independence. It's just a depiction of the independence we have as African countries. So compared to how we used to being dependent on Western countries, I think Africa is currently finding its voice. Yeah.
My name is Eugene Omondi from Goethe Institute, Kenya. It really means a lot to me, though I feel that the organization to some extent has been a letdown in some catastrophic like drought, majorly affecting the Horn of Africa mostly. The issue that has been arising recently, the coups that have been happening maybe in West Africa, and the current ones has happened in Sudan, that has brought a lot of humanitarian crisis. I think these are the things that we should be focusing while we are celebrating this. And going forth, I would like the leaders to try to focus on curb such kind of thing. To my African leaders, they can do much better than they have done. I don't dispute that most of them have done a great job, but I still believe there is a room to make improvement in how we govern ourselves.
Critical surgical supplies donated by the International Committee of the Red Cross are being distributed to 7 hospitals in the Sudanese capital, Khartoum. ICRC Africa's spokesperson Alona Sinenka says only 20% of the health facilities in Khartoum are still functioning after more than a month of fighting between 2 rival military factions. Sinenko tells VOA's Carol Van Dam that Sudanese hospitals were forced to close for a number of reasons.
The lack of staff, because many people have fled, lack of medical and surgical supplies. Some of them were damaged because the fighting was taking place very close to the heavily populated residential areas. And then just there's no water and there's no electricity. So it's no wonder that many stopped functioning, because it is extremely difficult, almost impossible to work in these conditions. And actually, the estimates that we have now is that some 80% of hospitals are no longer functioning. And this is why it is so hugely important for us to try to support those that are still providing services as soon as we can. So we donated these medical supplies to the Ministry of Health, and they are delivering them to the hospitals, and we hope that the ceasefire holds.
What kinds of critical medical supplies are you supplying?
Antibiotic, dressing material, surgical material, the things that you would need in an emergency to treat hundreds of critically wounded people.
What do the hospitals need right now in addition to what you're able to give them?
They need absolutely everything. And if we talk about what the hospital needs, I think the first thing where we need to start is they need water and electricity and food for their staff, because in Khartoum, because of the damage to the civilian infrastructure, like the hospitals are functioning without water, without electricity, the markets are no longer functioning, and they lack absolutely everything. And then, of course, treating wounded people is important and urgent, but at the same time, we should not forget that there's also all the other people with medical conditions and the basic health needs.
And what about the people who have been killed in the clashes? Are their bodies being identified? Are they being collected and identified?
Yes, indeed. It is an important topic that is sometimes overlooked. So we are working with the volunteers from the Sudanese Red Crescent Society, and we have supported them, donated them body bags, and it is a hugely important issue to be able to, yes, of course, collect people who were killed in the fighting, but also properly identify them before they get buried, because unless this is done, we are facing a huge protection crisis in the years to come, where families who will be looking for their loved ones, they will not be able to find them, and that would create enormous pain and suffering for many years sometimes.
That's Alona Sinenko, Africa spokesperson for the ICRC. She was speaking with VOA's Carol Van Dam from Nairobi, Kenya. The two sides in the conflict have accused each other of violating the latest ceasefire that both sides signed amid pressure to allow aid to reach the needy and give citizens a safe path out of the conflict zones. Algerian opposition figure Karim Tabou, one of the most recognizable faces in the Hirak pro-democracy movement that began in February 2019, has been taken into custody for unspecified reasons. His brother said plainclothes police officers arrested him at home without informing him when he would appear before prosecutors or the charges he might face. Tabu, who leads a small opposition party, the Democratic and Social Union, was sentenced in March 2020 to a year in jail for undermining national security over his criticism of the army's involvement in politics. William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington, discussed the continued crackdown on Algeria's opposition with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
This is the Algerian regime continuing to criminalize criticism. There's been an escalation of repression in recent months of human rights activists, leaders of the political opposition, and journalists, especially those that might be able to mount some kind of political movement in advance of the next presidential elections. So you've had increased prison sentences for some people already in detention, especially long sentences for people for simply being interviewed in the press and saying controversial things or Facebook posts. Some Algerian activists count now 300 prisoners of opinion in Algeria. That number seems to be growing. In terms of Tebboune himself, his issue always seems to be the same issue over the last 10 or 15 years. It's that he speaks out against the army getting involved in politics. And then when he does that, the army gets involved in politics by arresting him. He also talks a lot about the surveillance state and the way the Algerian regime electronically keeps an eye on its opponents. He rose to fame because he was the deputy and next in line to take over the FFS party. This was the most prominent Algerian opposition political party since 1963. And then he left the party in 2011 over this issue, that he was speaking out against the army in ways that were greater than what his party wanted him to do. Now he was arrested in 2019, in 2021, in 2022, and then incarcerated for long periods for speech crimes. But the way I think to see this is the democracy activists and human rights figures in Algeria are constantly testing red lines. And so when these arrests happen, you have to think about, is the regime feeling more uncomfortable now, so they feel a need to crack down, or are they feeling feeling more comfortable because of the rise of the price of oil and gas, and they've bought some social peace through ability to distribute more benefits to the Algerian people, so it's time to crack down on the opposition. I would say that the regime's feeling a little more vulnerable these days, despite the fact that it's been buoyed by the high need for its gas in Europe. And it believes that if it, arrests enough people, it can quiet enough of the population to have what it considers a modicum of social peace and ability to hang on to power.
The Hirak protests had forced longtime President Abdelaziz Bouteflika to step down, and demonstrations continued in a push for a deep reform, and the protests demanded a sweeping overhaul of the ruling system in Algeria, which is in place since Algeria's independence from France in 1962. Do you see any prospect for Al-Hirak to achieve that goal?
Not Hirak. So it's a constant state of affairs in Algeria that you have protests going on. When it starts to threaten the regime is when you have these greater crackdowns like we had beginning in mid to late 2019 after President Bouteflika stepped down. Now, the reason why the Hirak movement was able to force Bouteflika out of power has been much studied, but the consensus of a lot of the analysis seems to be that when the demands were specific, like this president cannot stay, it was easier for the regime to make that happen and for the protesters' objectives to be realized. But when it becomes vague, like change the entire system or the entire political class must step down, it's much harder for the regime to respond to it because they're basically needing to leave the scene with no transition in place. And one of the things where I did criticize the Hirak movement for is you can't replace the system without another system being proposed, and that never really happened.
That was William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington, speaking to VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi. You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. For more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. A man accused of ordering the killing of some 2,000 Tutsis who were seeking refuge in a church during Rwanda's 1994 genocide has been arrested in South Africa. Reuters says former police officer Falangisi Kaishima has been on the run since 2001 when the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda indicted him for genocide over his role in the destruction of the Nyanga Catholic Church in Kibyo Prefecture. Kaishima is expected to be flown to Rwanda for trial. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres welcomed the arrest, saying it sends a powerful message that those who are alleged to have committed such crimes cannot evade justice and will eventually be held accountable. An estimated 800,000 ethnic Tutsis and Hutu moderates were killed during Rwanda's genocide, orchestrated by an extremist Hutu regime and executed by local officials and ordinary citizens. In May 2020, another mastermind of the genocide, Felicien Kabuga, was arrested in France after 26 years on the run. Only three fugitives indicted by the International Tribunal remain at large. Reuters reports Senegalese opposition leader Ousmane Sonko urged supporters yesterday to join him on a march of defiance to the capital after a prosecutor asked the court to find him guilty and sentence him to 10 years in prison on rape charges. The verdict is expected on June 1st. Such a sentence would likely bar him from running for president in next year's election. The case has fueled unrest, scarring Senegal's image as one of West Africa's most stable democracies. Reuters says the proposed march could bring further instability to Senegal, where violent protests have taken place since Sonko was first detained for alleged rape and death threats to a woman who worked in a massage parlor in 2021. He denies wrongdoing and has boycotted the court proceedings. Tina Turner, the queen of rock and roll, died peacefully yesterday at the age of 83 after a long illness in her home near Zurich, Switzerland. In talking to me, Heather Maxwell, host of VOA's Music Time in Africa, said she actually cried when she first heard about the passing of the 12-time Grammy winner Tina Turner.
Left a good job in the city. Working for the man every night and day. And I never lost one minute of sleep. And I was worried about the way that things might have been.
You know, I just cried this morning. Yesterday I was just numb. Of course, she's 83. She lived a good, healthy, successful life. So that's all good, you know. And she died peacefully, but I was sad, but this morning I was really moved when I was watching, especially a YouTube video of her live performance of Proud Mary. Just the woman was exceptional, one of a kind, and it's just sad that she's no longer on this earth with us.
A trailblazer and a diva, I'm sure you know, she inspired the likes of Beyoncé, Rihanna, Christina Aguilera, Annie Lennox, mm-hmm. Amy Winehouse. Mm-hmm. I mean, it just goes on and on, her inspiration to the musical industry.
Oh, yeah. And not to mention her dance moves. I mean, apparently she taught Mick Jagger how to dance.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
She's a 12-time Grammy winner, a two-time Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductee.
I mean, her music, you know, it started way back in the 60s when she was with her first husband, Ike Turner, and they did mostly blues, but they were big hits back then. And then that relationship was, you know, widely known as being extremely tumultuous and violent, him against her. And she got out of that and then started doing what she wanted to do, which was rock and roll. I mean, she just loved rock and roll. And really, in, you know, if you look at American music history, rock and roll and blues are two sides of the same coin, almost, in terms of their roots and all that. But she wanted to do rock. And so she came back to life, kind of, and started doing what she wanted to do. And now Proud Mary has got to be one of my favorites of all time, because it's a slow, very simple song. There's like two chords to the whole song. And she actually did it with Ike in the very beginning. But she kept doing it once she did her own, had her own career, solo career. But she makes that song just so powerful and so exciting, even though it's actually a very, very simple, kind of boring song. Nobody else can actually perform that song and make it sound good and exciting like she can. She's like the only one that could actually do that song well. So that's one of my favorite songs. And what's Love Got to Do with It, of course.
Like you mentioned, with Ike Turner, Ike and Tina Turner. Mm-hmm. She was famous, but she became even more famous with her solo career.
Yes. And I think, though, yes, most of that was her story and her living through that violence, that oppression, and coming out still shining and even more beautiful and more powerful than before is what I think was her main attraction. People, especially women across the board, loved and admired her for that power that she had to come back. It gave women hope and strength.
And Heather, like you mentioned, her dancing move was very, very popular for African fans, her music as well. And they were kind of gratified in 1985 when this We Are the World, a charity single, originally recorded by the supergroup USA for Africa to help famine victims in Ethiopia, came out. And her connection to Africa is also very strong.
Yes, it is. And you mentioned that. I think earlier we spoke, you mentioned her participation in South Africa during apartheid, even though that had some of its problems. But, you know, just this morning, Yahis, I was speaking to one of my trusted reporters in Nairobi, who's currently in Ethiopia, in Addis, and he was talking all about it. He said people are so upset.
That was Heather Maxwell, host of VOA's Music Time in Africa, remembering Tina Turner, the queen of rock and roll. There was a bit of an upset in the Basketball Africa League semifinals yesterday, and VOA's Mokbili Abaro has been covering the games, and here he is.
Thank you for having me, Yahis.
So, first question. Did Petro de la Luanda run out of petrol losing against AS Douanes? What happened?
I definitely would think, yes, they did. For the most part, I pretty much think that all the analysts had Petro de Luanda making it to the finals. Unfortunately for them, they ran into an AS Douanes side from Senegal that really just played with more desperation, that really wanted it more than them. They were playing very complacent, and they almost expected AS Douanes to just roll over, and they really didn't. They rolled over them.
Complacency. In other games, Ahli beat State Malian 78-73. What were some key takeaways from that game?
I would say that Al Ahli and Stade Malien, the entirety of the game was pretty much back and forth. Jackson and I were actually in studio doing the play-by-play, and they were going back and forth, some 5-point leads here, 5-point leads there. The integral part was in the fourth quarter, where the main player for the Stade Malien side, Ali Odiera, was fouled out. He's a rim protector, and as soon as he was out, Al Ahly was able to start getting to the paint more, start scoring a little bit easier, and also free throws. They were missing a lot of free throws on both sides, but Stade Malien more so than anything else, that cost them the game.
Now, Mokbil, looking ahead to the third place game. That was sport analyst Mokbil Yabaro. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and our engineer, Shogun Chung, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.